everyone. I'm Haley Allam, and this is Mom Life in Luxembourg. If you're a parent new to Luxembourg, then this is the podcast for you. From crèches to crèmes, we'll cover everything you need to know about raising kids and living your best life in the Grand Duchy. Hi, Caroline. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Haley. Thank you so much for having me.
I'm very excited that you could join us today, all the way from Lyon. I suppose we should probably start with saying that you are not actually physically in Luxembourg and you don't live in Luxembourg at all, which is a little different for this show. However, my tagline for the show is from crèches to crèmes, everything you need to know about raising kids and living your best life in the Grand Duchy. And for me, that really extends to all of Europe, especially places that you can get to in a sort of quick and easy manner. One of the big, my favorite things about living in Luxembourg is that I am centrally located to all over Europe. And so even though I have three kids, it is possible for me to continue to travel. So I thought I wanted to have you on the show to talk all about you and your business, Wine Dine Caroline, and your new podcast.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm in Lyon, so I'm not that far from Luxembourg. And I actually drove there a couple of years ago on my way to the Netherlands. I've been there once. Very interesting. It was different than what I was expecting. I didn't really realize it would like jut up out of this cliff. I don't know. I had no idea what it would be like. So it was interesting.
Honestly, the weather's terrible. But besides that, I love it here. It's clean. It's like cleaner, slower, quieter version of Paris without all the cool architecture.
I love that. Yeah. No, it's nice. And so it is pretty easy to get here. I think you can take a train as well, but it's easy to get to Lyon. And it is, obviously, you're in between all this great stuff. And so are we. I think that's something that these cities have in common, is a country and a city have in common, is that they're crossroads.
Yeah. The tour I took of Luxembourg, this hop on, hop off, all I really got from it was that it just changed hands so many times. Like, it's been conquered, which is weird because it's supposed to be a fortress. But anyways, I digress. So I'd love to hear about you, because you are living your best expat life, because you are not actually French. I believe you are American.
Yes, I'm American and British.
Oh, you are. Okay. So tell me your story. How'd you get here and what are you doing?
Oh, it's a long story. My parents are divorced. We'll start with that. So my dad has lived in London since 1989 and I moved in with him when I was 16. So I grew up with my mother and my stepfather in California. But when I was 16, I moved to London and went to the American school in London. I'm sure there's an American school in Luxembourg. It's probably the sister school to ASL. And that is when my path just really took me to Europe. I spent 9 years in London and then 1 year bouncing around France. And then actually did go back to the States for 4 years. I was in the Bay Area again as an adult from age 26 to 30 and just didn't vibe.
I have a question about that. So you came basically from 16, you didn't live in the States anymore. And when you came back, you just said that you didn't vibe. Why? What was that like?
So basically when I went back to the States, I was 25, 26, and I was there 4 years. And then in 2016, the Brexit vote happened. And then Trump also happened, that vote. And so I realized, okay, I need to go back to Europe. I need to go back to France before Brexit actually kicks in, because there were a number of years that basically we had before between the vote and actual Brexit. And so when I came back to Europe is when I realized what was missing. And it was that a huge part of my identity since I was 16 was being foreign, was being an American. And once you're an American here, you have a special, you're special, you're different. And when I went back, all of my specialness disappeared.
Wow.
And it's funny because my friend of mine, her husband is French. He's a chef. And he was in the UK for a really long time. And then he came back here and they met here during COVID. And he gave a shot and he hated being here. He didn't want to be in France and they ended up moving to Germany. And it's the same thing, like basically being a French chef anywhere else, big deal. But you come to France and you're a French chef, you're just a chef. And so I think being back in the States, this huge part of my identity that I didn't even really realize was such a core part of who I am just evaporated overnight. And there's a lot of other reasons. I think once you live in places with a social safety net and healthcare and public transportation and all of the wonderful things that we enjoy here, it's hard to go back.
Yeah.
So I wasn't very happy there. Honestly, those were the worst years of my life. I was miserable.
Oh, and so, San Francisco's
coming back with
the best, I think.
It's overrated. I don't know. It's so expensive. And I think the people there really think that it's the best place in the world. And I'm like, have you been anywhere? Like, it's dirty, full of crazy people. Like, it doesn't take care of its people. It's sad. It is a beautiful city. And there are a lot of great things about it, including the food and the wine. But I was ready to leave.
Yeah. It's very interesting to hear your perspective, because a lot of us that are in this boat that listen to this podcast are raising kids that are going to be the foreigner, whether or not they're American or wherever. They're not Luxembourgish. So when they go back, then they're not going to be the foreigner anymore. And especially my kids, my middle, he was 4 when we moved here, and he feels deeply disenfranchised that he had to leave California and come to Europe. I know, you're 4, buddy. However, I can see, we've been here for 3 years now, his identity is starting to evolve, and we'll see what happens if he wants to go to university back home or not. Who knows?
Yeah, I think it was hard. I also went to university in the UK. So I didn't have the American college experience. I didn't really have the American high school experience. I have the accent.
You do.
But other than that, I don't feel that American. And I am in certain ways. Obviously, I still spent my childhood there, but I don't pretend to be French. They would never allow it. And I wouldn't have no desire to do that anyway, because as I said, I like being American abroad.
Speaking of dinner parties, I suppose that's a pretty good segue into your Wine Dine Caroline business. Tell me about it. Tell me how you got into it. Tell me about your wine certification. Tell me everything.
The name came up a while ago. God, maybe even 15 or so years ago, because it's catchy. But I've always been in wine. So when I did my undergrad at Oxford, I joined the Competitive Blind Wine Tasting Society.
So highbrow. You went to Oxford and you joined Competitive Wine Tasting. It's amazing.
Yeah, we have a match against Cambridge every year. And it was a blast. So I got a really unique education in wine through that. And then that spits out, we're the wine Illuminati. We're all over the world. It spits people out into the industry. Mm-hmm. And I was the sacrifice for my year. So I ended up staying in London after uni. And I did spend a year at the Cordon Bleu learning about cooking. And then I got a job in wine, selling wine to bars and restaurants with a company called Bibendum. Then I did my WSET in London. So I did the 2, the 3, and then the 1 for 4.
WSET is the sommelier test, right?
It's the Wine and Spirits Education Trust. So in the States, we have a different path, although WSET is very popular there now as well. We have the Court of Master Somm, the CMS, and that is a sommelier exam. So a sommelier is someone who runs a restaurant wine program and serves wine in restaurants. The WSET is something that certainly elsewhere in the world would qualify you to be a somm, but it is not just that. The CMS has a lot more about service. So there's a lot more emphasis on service and working in restaurants, whereas the WSET is basically for everyone else. And what's funny is that the wine industry has really been reduced to this word sommelier, particularly with the media and these like somm movies, but like somms are a tiny percentage of the wine industry. And it's not an easy job. Somms, you age out of being a somm at a certain point because you don't want to work the floor at a restaurant when you're 50 years old.
I can see that.
Like, people do, and there's obviously wine directors and stuff like that, but also these days, how many restaurants even have a sommelier? So it's not that many, really. You're really only going to get a sommelier at a high-end restaurant. So I think the W said, if you are interested, anyone listening to this is interested in furthering your wine education, I would definitely stick with W set over the Court of Master Somms, because you can learn service, practice, and I'm sure you can learn service on your own, but you'll get a more holistic education about the wine industry as a whole with the WSET.
I think I have a friend who's taking it, but isn't level 4, doesn't have a notoriously low pass rate?
I don't know. I think it's probably harder now than it was when I did it, but it's a level 4 is at least the year of your life, probably 2.
Wow. How many levels
are? It's hard. There might be like a 5th level. I'm not even sure. Level 4 is where you would stop this. And then you would do the Master of Wine next. The Master of Wine is the impossible one. I did get into that program and I did do a pretty pathetic attempt at it during COVID, but I ultimately decided that I did not care enough.
So was it COVID that brought on this Wine Dine Caroline idea?
No. So I have had my Instagram since like 2013. Wine Dine Caroline is a persona. It's my Instagram and now this podcast and sort of the media side of things. My like real business is Leon Wine Tasting.
Okay.
So Leon Wine Tasting is its own entity, and that is tourist ateliers. We have a 2-hour tasting in the heart of Lyon. We do them every day. And they are a masterclass, basically, in all the wines of Lyon. So that's Burgundy, Beaujolais, the Rhone. There's always a wild card that could be Jura. But basically, I have a 2-hour radius from Lyon.
I'm going to ask you about the wines from Lyon, because if you're coming from farther away and not France, like, for example, I'm from California. I can tell you about California wines, but European wines, I'm like, I don't know. So if you don't know a lot about French wines, is this a good place to start?
Absolutely. We're very lucky because we are, again, a crossroads. And so that means that there are a lot of different wine regions that feed into Lyon and that create our wine culture. So when you go to Bordeaux, you're only going to really try Bordeaux. But here we have access to Burgundy, Beaujolais, the Rhone, Savoie, Jura, Auvergne. We have a lot of wines that come into play here that create the wine culture. Our promise at Lyon Wine Tasting is that you will learn about the local wines, but you'll also learn how to taste wine. So basically, where Lyon is, it is in the Rhone Valley. And so we are at the top of the Rhone Valley. Lyon is on the eastern side of France. We are to the west of the Alps and east of the Massif Central, which is a huge mountain range. So we're in between these two big mountain ranges, and there's this valley. So the wines that come here and that make up a huge part of our wine culture, of course, are Burgundy. Burgundy is one of the most famous wine regions in the world. It is arguably the most expensive wine in the world, and that is Pinot Noir and Chardonnay.
Okay, white Burgundy. Check. Write that down.
White Burgundy is Chardonnay. There is another grape, Aligoté, that is awesome, but you don't see it as much. And then red Burgundy is Pinot Noir. Burgundy is small. And when you go there, the vineyards are minuscule. The plots are minuscule. It's very rare. It's very expensive. And there's a lot of, it's very overpriced, I have to say, these days. And there's a lot of crappy Burgundy that's still going to cost you 50 euros. So
wow,
be careful with Burgundy. Yeah. But if you have the money and you want to spend it on excellent wine, Burgundy is where you end up eventually if you're getting into wine, because it's the pinnacle. They've been making wine there for 1,000 years, and they're very good at it. Then we have just south of Burgundy, Beaujolais, which is basically Burgundy's redheaded stepchild and has always had a bad reputation. Not a bad reputation, it hasn't always had a bad reputation, but it does, has for the past 30 years because of Beaujolais Nouveau, which is a product that comes out the third Thursday of November and is just a really light, easy drinking, fruity Coca-Cola juice wine. It's fun, but not particularly high quality. And it really flooded the market in the 80s and 90s, and people are over it. And so the region has a reputation of being cheap and crappy, even though there's a lot of really good wine there that is excellent value. So Beaujolais is going to be Gamay, the Gamay grape, which is also light and fruity, like Pinot Noir. I love Gamay. I love Beaujolais. I actually think Beaujolais is a much nicer place to visit for a wine trip than Burgundy, because in Burgundy, they don't need you. They don't care about you. They don't want your visit. If you're not important in the wine industry, their doors are closed to you. Anyone good doesn't have time for you. So as a tourist, they just do not care.
Wow.
And yeah, they like, why? They don't have enough wine anyway. They don't have any wine to sell to you. So fair enough. Like, they're doing their thing. They don't care about you. You go to Beaujolais and they're like, please try our wonderful wine. We love you here. Open doors, really nice people. Also, Beaujolais is very pretty. Rolling hills, castles everywhere. I actually think Beaujolais is more beautiful than Burgundy. So I highly recommend Beaujolais. And you can totally hit Burgundy and Beaujolais and then come to Lyon on your way down. I guess from Luxembourg, you would come in from the side, but still. Beaujolais is gorgeous, and I love it. There are whites in Beaujolais. They are pretty rare, and those are Chardonnay as well.
Okay, good to know.
Then you're in Lyon. So basically, Beaujolais is just north of Lyon. If I got in my car right now, I could be in Beaujolais in 30, 40 minutes.
I have to ask you, what about Bordeaux? Yeah. I know that's not in your geographical remit.
It's on the other side of the universe. It doesn't exist here. Bordeaux has nothing to do. We don't drink Bordeaux in Lyon. You won't even see it on a wine list.
Is it like a cross-country rivalry?
It's just another universe. It just doesn't exist. There's no connecting Lyon and Bordeaux because we have a mountain range in between them. There's no trains that connect them. The road that goes through that is like an engineering masterpiece because of these mountains. There was never a rail line. Getting to Bordeaux is not easy. It takes at a minimum, I would say, 6 hours or 7 hours in the car to get to Bordeaux. It's far.
Okay.
Yeah. So Bordeaux is not part of the wine culture here. I like Bordeaux a lot. I did a harvest there. And my husband's a wine merchant. He has a lot of great Bordeaux that nobody buys. And I'm like, dude, let me run a Bordeaux tasting. We'll get you some Bordeaux sales. But no, Bordeaux are awesome. Bordeaux is, compared to Burgundy, not pretty still. the smallest Bordeaux producer is 1,000 times bigger than the biggest Burgundy producer. This wow. scale.
Wow.
Yeah. Bordeaux is huge. Bordeaux is also English. Bordeaux exists because the English wanted wine and they colonized Bordeaux and fought over it for hundreds of years. And so Bordeaux is actually relatively unique in France in that it's a wine that was very much always about commercial power. Whereas Burgundy was made by monks and it was about making the best, nerdiest product. Bordeaux was like, how can we make the most money and make the most wine? And there is very good wine in Bordeaux that is technically awesome, but it is made in huge quantities.
Wow, this is so interesting. I am floored.
Yeah, I like Bordeaux, though. I'm not crapping on Bordeaux. I do like it a lot.
They're
but
like,
we don't drink it here.
They're Cabernets, right? Cabernet Sauvignon, that's the grape.
Cabernet Merlot blend.
Yeah, so that's what I liked back in California. Although weirdly, when I go home now, I'm like, whoa, it's too much.
It's a lot, yeah. It's too much. And that's how we feel about them here. Because if you want your big wine, so both Pinot Noir and Gamay from Burgundy and Beaujolais are actually pretty light red. If you want a big red here, we're going to go south of Lyon to the northern Rhone. So if I hopped in my car and I went north for 40 minutes, I'd be in Beaujolais. But if I hop in my car and I go south for 40 minutes, I'm in Côte Rôtie. I'm in the northern Rhone. The northern Rhone is also minuscule. And these are Syrah wines. So they are big, bold reds. They're not as big and bold as Bordeaux. Some of them are. But it's a pretty versatile grape that can make lighter styles as well. They are also, small quantities and can get very expensive or getting more expensive and more high demand. And they do have some really interesting whites down there as well that are made in minuscule quantities. There's one appellation called Condrieu that makes Viognier, which is very popular and very expensive. And then Condrieu is tiny. And then all the other whites from that region are so few and far between that they're quite hard to find. And those would be blends of Marsan and Roussan. I like those wines a lot. If you find like a white Saint-Joseph or a white Croz Hermitage or a Santerre or a White Hermitage, those are going to be really interesting.
Does interesting mean good or does interesting mean?
Yeah, I love them. I think they're amazing. Interesting means interesting too. There's weird wines like the Jura. You're not that far from the Jura, are you? In Luxembourg, Jura has some weird wines that are super interesting and you might not like them, but you can still appreciate that they're interesting.
Okay.
I like them. I like everything pretty much. I don't like really microbially messed up natural wine, which happens. There's some really excellent natural wine. There's some great natural winemakers who know what they're doing. And then there's a lot of natural wine that is off, essentially. So bio is organic. That's regulated. That is about farming practice. And then additions in the winery. There's plenty of great organic wine now.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean anything. Natural wine and organic wine are not the same thing. Natural wine basically means that they are probably not going to inoculate with yeast, which can lead to an overgrowth of messed up yeast. Also, they might not filter, which can lead to an overgrowth of weird bacteria, and also that they will not add sufficient sulfites to keep the wine preserved for wherever it needs to go. And sulfites are the boogeyman. They are not harmful in the quantities that they show up in wine, and they're necessary to keep your wine from turning into vinegar.
Okay. Sold. I like a nice sulfite.
Yeah.
Okay. Can we go back to you in Oxford? So you were just in college when everyone else is like getting drunk off of like screwdrivers. Yeah. You knew that you had a good nose. You knew that you had a good palate. Like, you knew that you were good at this. Or is this like a growth mindset? Anybody can be good at this.
I was into food at that point already. I liked to cook. And then I liked wine. And then it became pretty clear that I was good at it. But that took a little while. It's hard. You have to practice. Some people are going to be better than other women are better than men. Generally, we have more sensitive palates. But, and more sensitive smell. It requires study. I was a wizard at the time that I was doing it, but I was practicing all the time. We were tasting 40 wines a week in the run-up to the match. I got very good at it, right? If you tried to do blind tasting on something now, if it was easy, I could probably get it. But if it was anything remotely obscure, it would be difficult for me. These days also, it is harder than it's always harder. When I did it, it was harder than it had been 10 years ago because wine is evolving and because there are so many different kinds of wine now, because you can make a wine in the Northern Rhone that feels more like a wine from California and vice versa. So the rules that used to really exist around winemaking are a lot looser now in terms of, they're not looser in France, they're not looser, but the rules about what something tastes like and the kind of norms expanded a lot. So it's never been harder and it will always continue to get harder to learn about wine because it's always getting more interesting and changing.
Okay. I feel out of my league a lot, but I'm still down for a 2-hour masterclass. I don't want this to turn into a downer, but I've read articles that a lot of people aren't drinking anymore and the demand for wine is going down. Is that something that you're seeing or not so much?
Absolutely. And I don't think it's a downer. The wine industry, certainly throughout the end of the 20th century, was really inflated. I don't think we need more crappy wine on the market. And I don't think we need to be drinking as much as we do. I'm 38. I'm a millennial. We were very much a generation that drinks a lot and drank a lot, especially as women. Historically, women haven't really been able to drink that much because, first of all, socially it was unacceptable, but we still have no time. We can't be hungover all the time. So my generation was very much encouraged to be drunk all the time, and I don't necessarily think that's positive. So for me, the death of the alcohol industry, blah, 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 whatever, I don't care. The good stuff is going to still have a market, and crappy mass-produced wine can really die for all I care. I don't care. Yeah. And I don't think so much of that is made by machines and not people. Obviously, there's people involved, but the larger scale wine operations are McDonald's. Do we really need more McDonald's? And I don't have a problem with younger people drinking less. I think they're probably right about that.
Okay.
But I wish I had been a little more educated on the dangers of alcohol.
Yeah, I understand. I'm also a millennial. Elder millennial. Zennial.
Yeah, elder millennial. Yeah.
I want to talk about your podcast.
The podcast.
So first of all, it's called The Fishwives of Paris, but you're in Lyon.
The Real Fishwives.
I love the name Fishwife. Sometimes I call myself a fishwife to my husband and he thinks that's funny. So talk to me about the inspiration for that, what it's about. Tell me about it.
So basically, during the pandemic, my friend Emily Monaco and I had a podcast called The Terroir Podcast, where we talked about different regions of France, the food and wine. Emily's a journalist in Paris, and she's been here for 20 years. She's really an incredible fountain of information about everything French cooking, French food, French ingredients. She's truly, truly excellent and an excellent writer and just someone who has such an incredible wealth of knowledge. And so this podcast was a fun project for us. Neither of us got paid a dime for it. It was quite difficult to maintain because of that.
And
it was just a different level. It was a pandemic and I didn't have a particularly big following at that time and it just fizzled out. So in the meantime, I think we had always dreamed of doing something else. And the timing just became right to revitalize this idea of a podcast about French food and wine. But this time it's 2025. We recorded it all in 4K. It's going to go on YouTube. And it's not about regions. It's about a thing, right? So we have episodes. We have recorded the whole season one up front, which is great because I became pregnant. This will be my maternity leave. So basically, the first season we have topics was macaron or champagne is one. We also have some interviews with some amazing people like Apollonia Poilin, who's a famous baker in Paris. So we have a really varied kind of roster in year one to see what people like. It's about 30 minutes long and it's really good. I'm really excited about it. So we're launching that on September 16th and there'll be one episode every other week for the first season.
How long does the season go?
It will be almost a year. We have 24 episodes in the bank.
Wow. Good for you.
Yeah.
Wow. That's a lot.
It's hard to schedule because our producer, Steven, was in London. He's a long-term friend of mine. Who actually is married to a girl at Oxford. So that's how I know him. I've known him for a very long time. And we've talked for 12 years about making TV together, but there is no TV anymore.
Yeah.
No one's going to give me money for a TV show because I'm not Stanley Tucci. And so we decided, okay, we can make TV, but we'll make it a podcast because that's certainly logistically easier. But when we're filming, we are five people in the room, me and Emily, and then Steven and a videographer and a runner. So it's a big project.
That is a big project. This is me and my phone and the studio.
Yeah.
That's it.
It's awesome though. It's different. The thing is, you're also appealing to a pretty niche audience.
Very niche.
We are trying to appeal to any Anglophone who's interested in French food. And that's a pretty big niche.
Yeah. Count me in. I'm going to listen for sure. But by the time this episode comes out, The Real Fishwives of Paris will already be out because this is going to, we're launching this season in October-ish.
Okay, perfect. Yeah. That's great.
What's your Instagram handle?
Podcast Instagram is Real Fishwives of Paris.
Okay. Before we go, you mentioned that you're pregnant. When are you due?
I'm due at the end of November.
Oh, so exciting. Yeah. So Sagittarius baby?
Yeah, I think so. Unless he comes early and then he might be a Scorpio. But I don't love being pregnant. I'm not going to lie. And I'm having a really easy pregnancy, but my brain is dead and I'm tired. Our first child probably will be my only child. I can't wait to, it's long right now. We're recording in September. I'm like, I'm still 3 months to go, basically.
It's so weird that when you're not pregnant, the time flies. But when you are pregnant, every week you're like, oh my God.
What new weird thing is going to happen to my body? It's been honestly very easy. I haven't had anything too weird go on and I mostly am just tired. But
have you started not being able to sleep yet? Because your body does that as a F you. Before the baby comes.
That's a great one. Definitely having it. I'm like hot and cold at the same time in bed. So, and normally I could wear pajamas for 3 nights and they wouldn't be disgusting. But right now I'm changing pajamas every night. I'm just a sweaty mess.
Yeah. So. Good times. Good times. Lucky you.
Great. I think this every, like, oh, I love being pregnant. I'm like, what propaganda is this?
No, but then you forget how much it sucks. Yeah. And then you have another baby and you're like, oh, it still sucks. Yep, I remember this.
It's funny. We'll see. We'll see if there's more. I feel like we might be good with one. But
you might want to.
I do think you get treated nicely. I like being treated well, but I get treated pretty well in my life anyway. So I'm showing now properly, and that's fun in some ways, but also I just had to buy my first batch of maternity clothes, and it is so hard. It's hard for me to shop here even when I'm not pregnant because I am not a skinny French girl.
Yeah, I hate that.
And you can't buy anything maternity unless it's online. So you have to buy all this stuff and send it back and get a new size. So I'm wearing my maternity jeans for the first time today. And I'm like, they're weird, but I'll get used to it.
Maternity jeans were like my favorite part. I'm like, why don't I wear these all the time? Why would anyone want to have?
Where did you get them from? Because I don't like these ones, really. I think I need the H&M ones. They're what people say are good.
Yeah, I was going to say H&M or Gap.
Okay.
Athleta.
That's a good shot.
If you can handle the shipping or whatever. I guess weirdly, I was pregnant in Dubai, but yet I had American stuff. I don't know. I don't remember.
Oh, yeah. I have a sister coming in soon. I might get her to bring me some stuff.
Yeah. There's also Shapito.
That's a good idea.
Although I don't know about the tariffs and stuff. That's a whole nother thing. So you are never moving back to the States. The new American dream is to bail America and move to Europe.
Yeah. I've been gone forever. I'm never going back. I married a French man. He owns a wine shop. We're not leaving.
Yeah.
We're not leaving. I do hope that I hope and believe that I have to, that things will improve eventually in the States, especially for mothers and children and families, and that people will see the light about healthcare and infrastructure and all that stuff, because it is better here.
It's wildly better. And I feel like you just don't get that memo until you're over here. Yeah.
It's less shiny. Like you said, like we don't have the container store. Like there's like stuff like that. Like we don't have as much stuff, and you tend to have smaller apartments and smaller spaces. I'm in this giant room. Like we have a beautiful home here, and there's a difference between trying to live in Paris and trying to live here. It's cheaper in Lyon, but this is still a city that is considered quite expensive for French standards, but it's a lot cheaper than Paris. Life is really good. I love my life here. I feel well integrated without pretending to be French, and I will get my French nationality, and I'm going to have a French child. That's trippy. Our kid is going to be French.
If you're born in France, you get French citizenship, or is that through Papa?
I think it's both. Our kid will definitely be French, certainly one way or the other. Definitely. I think it is both. I think if we were two Americans, I don't know if our kid would be French. I don't know.
Okay.
But our kid is also American.
Yeah.
Because I'm American.
Yeah. All right. Caroline, thank you so much. This was great. And that's a wrap on this episode of Mom Life in Luxembourg. If you like the show, I'd love to hear from you. Please feel free to leave a comment, or better yet, share with another mom friend. And if there's a topic you'd like to see covered or you want to be on the show yourself, please email me at momlife@rtl.lu. And if you're feeling social, you can always reach me on Facebook and Instagram @momlifeinluxembourg. Thanks so much and have a great day.